It
things.
Does. It looks good.
And of course, some lighting as well, which I think the lighting gives me a headache. Very interestingly enough. And it doesn't help. But at the end of the day, I realized that if we're going to upgrade Brain Food Live, we really need to basically improve the tech, which I think we've done.
Maybe you should get one of those light boxes that will fill you with serotonin at the same time.
I'm not aware of this product, but I'm more than happy to experiment. Yeah. It's all about improvement, 2020. Anyway, we are live. So welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on Air. This is season two. I never thought we'd ever do a second series of this, but it was so popular last year. And actually, we enjoyed it as well. So we're going to do it again this year. Another 40 episodes lined up for you, talking about recruiting brain food and all the other good stuff that hangs around that. But before we kick off, some big news. Basically, Brain Food Live is now supporting sponsors, thank God, which are going to help us basically improve the show. So a quick shout out to our first sponsor for 2020. This is Pass. Pass Technologies, they're a company that basically do background screening. And they automate and centralize that. If you're not using any kind of technology for doing background checks, you really need to get involved with something there. Pass have actually very generously given us and all the viewers here a free 1 month pass, interestingly enough, on their application platform. So you can check it out right there. That's Pass. For CV and background screening. Okay, I'm joined as ever by my co-host and chief promoter. I hope you're still the chief promoter of Recruiting Brain Food, Adam. Adam Gordon, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. Hopefully I am still the chief promoter. I think I did a good job on promoting the first edition of Recruiting Brain Food. One thing that I've noticed is, I mean, I post quite a lot of stuff on LinkedIn, but it's really ironic. I get more likes and comments every time I share my sort of summary of the brain food than anything I post that's just my own content.
Do you know why that is?
It's because you're so much more popular than me, basically.
No. It's nothing to do with me. It's to do with the fact that you're writing and adding value in the copy rather than just link sharing. So when you start bullet pointing things out and saying, hey, listen, this is interesting, that adds enough value. And it means that the person doesn't have to click on it to get the value. And I've tried to I've slowly discovering this, that basically if you're going to do a comment update in any social media, a flat out link share is not going to work. You've got to put like 50 to 80% of the value into that copy before it works. Anyway, we've got a great guest on today. We're going to be talking about skills for recruiters in the 2020s. But before we dive into that, we always reviewed last week's brain food before we kick off. So Adam, I just wanted to get your views on that and see what you enjoyed from last week's newsletter.
So I really enjoyed Basecamp's completely self-serving guide to internal communications. So while it is rich with useful tips around how to communicate better, it does say that meetings should be the last resort. And when you're talking, you're only talking to the people in the room. When you're writing to everybody. So it is basically, here's why you should use Basecamp more. But actually it is full of great tips. So, and internal communication is something I'm particularly passionate about. We definitely have too many meetings. That's 100% sure. I put in place a rule in my business, which is no meetings are longer than 30 minutes. And as far as I'm concerned, if they're longer than 30 minutes, then the people turning up for them haven't prepared. So I think there are quite a lot of things that you can take from it. But do take it with a pinch of salt, because it is designed to get you to use Basecamp more.
It is, absolutely. But this is how you would write, I would say, modern content. You know, if you take something that's your core value proposition and you just put together a fantastic bit of content like this, and you can read that and really get value from it, whether you're a remote business or a co-located business or whatever. I was speaking to David D'Souza about this, who obviously thinks a lot about culture and communication and all the rest of it. And he really liked this particular post. And absolutely, it's the key concept for him. And I think I share with him this importance. It's the difference between synchronicity and asynchronicity. We used to, in a co-located company, to always be synchronous, but we're working on different things. And we're thinking about different things. So if you're the boss and you say, oh, let's have a meeting, everyone has to drop everything and, of course, go to your meeting, but then they need to restart. And how unproductive is that when you have to get your head back in the frame? So synchronicity, asynchronicity, key concept. Click on the link I've just shared in the chat stream. It's going to be worth your while.
Yeah, I mean, I can't deny that. I look at my calendar and it's full from the start of the day to the end of the day. When do I actually get any time to do much thinking and really actually get on with all the follow-up from all the meetings? Not as much as I should. And so I definitely need to do less meetings for sure.
Yep. Managers, just on this final thing, managers are a little bit guilty of this because it sometimes can be a little bit of an ego thing and a little bit of a power play to the boss to say, have a meeting, I need to speak to you. And actually, what are you really doing? Are you just trying to, you know, beat your chest as some sort of alpha male here? Because there's no real business value for that, or it could be done in a different manner that's more efficient for the staff. So lots of things to think about and all of that. Anyway, check out the link. What else, Adam?
Just one really quick thing on that. I really was tickled with the story about the CEO of that travel, that bags. They make luggage.
And
the CEO of this business is engaged to the founder of Slack.
Yes, and she
had to resign because she'd been basically bullying people via Slack. She'd been berating her team via Slack. So not ideal. Away, that's what it's called. Thanks, Mitch.
It was an incredible story, actually, because this is almost a stereotypically, you know, right on left wing, you know, female dominant business. Using all the modern tech, so-called all the modern values and so forth. But, you know, it was apparently a toxic culture. So, you know, because of this bullying ego at the top. I mean, it was written by someone who I think had left the business or they'd been interviewed. So there was a lot of maybe sample bias there, but definitely worth checking that one out.
Yeah, the reason that made me think of that was just when you used the stereotype of the alpha male using the meeting for the
female, yeah, of course.
Okay, so I've never heard the word dork in this context, but top 100 Google dorks, which is basically strings, it's basically X-ray and Boolean strings. Really useful. If you don't know your sourcing, then go on there, start playing about with all of those, and quite frankly, you can just start using those. See what happens, adapt them, and you're going to be a pretty smart sourcer very, very quickly. So
that's it. Most people don't have any Google beyond and or operators. I hold my hand up and saying I'm pretty much can't do much beyond the site.com, the command. But if you dive just a little bit deeper, you can actually use Google in its genuine sense and get just used to the operators that you can input into that sort of input field, which this fellow, I've never met him, but I think he is a recruiter, has just listed 100 of these things that he uses regularly. So go ahead and check it out. I think Jonathan Kidder might have one of these as well. So lots of technical sources, I call them, are really sharing this type of content. So go check out that link if you're into getting better at Google.
Yeah. Glenn Cathy's blog about introversion should be considered part of a D&I initiative, a D&I subject. Mm. I mean, I think by default, every variance in humans is a diversity subject. But he's shining a spotlight on this, and it's something that most people don't consider. The challenge is, if you go into a business like Michael Page, there's no introverts, or if there is, they're in finance or something. They're not recruiters. So where does your competitive advantage start to be depleted based on, you know, your adherence to involving as many different types of people as possible. People in sales jobs have got to have certain personal characteristics. So there's a lot to think about in terms of this, but it's worth double clicking on it for sure.
That's actually a really salient point. And actually, the reason why I like you as co-host, Adam, because you're prepared to say things that are quite difficult to say. I think the prevailing kind of view is that we should have like default to diversity, if you like, and all our companies should basically be an accurate or as near as damn it representation of society at large, which overall it kind of makes feel sort of seems to be sensible. But of course, different businesses do different things. And you do wonder whether, as to use your example, leave Michael Page out of it, but potentially you're looking at any kind of sales organization, of which recruiters definitely are those. Maybe there's a balance there in the sense that they may lean towards more extroverted types, and maybe that characteristic or attribute might actually map to someone who's a bit more successful, let's say. Who knows? So I think the main thing is that we need to have diversity of business cultures. So I think it would be a wrong thing if everyone was diverse internally, but actually that meant that we're homogenous at a higher level. It would be better if we had like lots of different types of cultures, and then candidates can choose where's your fit. You know, do you really fit in a culture that's a foam banger and all that type of stuff? Or would you prefer a different business that is more receptive to different types of people? So definitely something we're talking about.
When we talked to Kevin about skills for recruiters in 2020, it'll, you know, in the green room, I was saying to you that I think that the TA structure is the most important thing to consider when you want to know what, you know, skills people should have. But the good thing about that is because we're splitting down, you know, we're kind of moving away from the 360 recruiter role, skills like sourcing, skills like marketing, they're skills that actually in introversion doesn't make any difference. You know, it's actually good if you are it can be a good skill set to have.
We should definitely bring it into the chat with Kevin. Actually, I'd be interested in his experimentation, because by having a more diverse set of roles in a business, I assume it should mean that you have more diverse types of people that are suitable for it. I'm guessing. But you're right. If everyone is like, okay, you want everyone on the phone, then presumably you're going to want more extroverted types. But if recruitment as a function starts diversifying, which it should do in my view, then actually that opens up the talent pool to different types of people and different types of characteristics. Yeah. Okay, one more thing before we bring Kevin on, man.
Okay, I've got so many, because it was a really great brain food. It was the best one I've seen in quite some time. It has to be Dominic Cummings. So,
right,
you know, I don't particularly like anything much about Dominic Cummings, except one thing, and that is that blog he wrote, that recruitment advert blog he wrote. I thought it was absolutely inspired. It was interesting. It was personalized. It was not corporate marketing that people just don't trust, which is ironic because I think most people don't trust Dominic Cummings. But it was written in a way that I would encourage anybody writing job adverts to go and take a look at it and study it. And the techniques in there around actually just talking, writing as you would talk, keeps people really, really engaged. So I thought it was a terrific job advert, and it's the only thing he's ever done that I've approved of.
Yeah, again, I mean, you've said something controversial, because which I happen to have sympathy with, actually. I canvassed opinion just in a basic straw poll. All the HR people I spoke to really hated his blog. Not only because he contravened like probably a lot of GDPR and diversity type issues, but also because of, you know, his political agenda, political leanings probably clash with most of people, I would say, in the people profession. But at the same time, he did what a lot of us preach, which just write authentically about the jobs you want, or the people you want in the business. And he did that.
Yeah, I suspect, I mean, if I paraphrase slightly, but, he said something about, but it was basically, I want to hire introverted weirdos who are like exceptional, you know, talented people. And I don't think very many of them are going to share his political persuasions, so I'm not sure it was in. I'm not sure he was the right person to do it.
No, but at the same time, you look at the impact, probably more clicks than any advert that the HM government has ever done, right? So probably. The power of having, again, a blog from a senior personality within the business, maybe yeah. outside of the corporate structure, can actually be an asset. That's something TA and recruiters generally need to think about. You don't always have to push things through your marketing and corporate channels, because if you've got a senior personality who is a quote-unquote influencer, actually his or her personal blog might be the most powerful channel you've got. Okay, anyway, I think we need to get Mr. Kevin Blair on.
Great.
Let's see where he's at. People who don't know Kevin should really follow the guy. He's been, I think, a thought leader for sure, but also a practitioner at the leading edge of rethinking about where recruitment is going. So I'm really pleased to bring him on and also to see what he's up to, because he's actually left IBM, I believe. So he's got some new things to share. Oh, and there he is. Hey. Kevin. Hey. Kevin Blair, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, very well, man. Very well. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, and to you. It's both of you.
Good to see you. And thank you for joining the show. We've got loads of people signed up, and I'm sure they're not signed up listening and with a view of listening to myself or Adam. But they wanted to get access to you and your kind of perspective, particularly on all the brilliant things you've been doing in the TA marketplace. But first things first, I understand you've actually left IBM, and you've got some news to share. Terms of, you know, what you're up to personally.
Yeah, that's right. No, so a little bit of a recruitment brain food exclusive. So yeah, I left IBM a couple of months ago, took some time out to get a decent amount of rest, moved across actually outside of corporate recruiting. So I moved over to be the VP of talent strategy Beamery to help create that middle ground between the vendor and the enterprise customer to really start to democratize the experiences I've had, because I've worked in some great companies. You mentioned four and a half years at Cisco and then just over 2 years with IBM, doing this work of redesigning the way that recruitment gets done. And you two both hit on it. Like one of the points is around the way that it needs to evolve and be a little bit different with different profiles of leaders. And recruiters. And so, so I wanted to challenge myself in a very different way. Wanted to take some of that learning experience in both a product and a consultative kind of format and help engineer some change in the market. And as I just mentioned, the two of you were saying about diverse types of people in recruiting, and it did make me laugh about the, could anything be diverse if introversion is now considered a subcategory of that? But I actually had two calls yesterday with two peers who are heads of recruitment at major technology companies, and we talked about the idea of coming together and starting to really, as a group, define these new roles of recruiters. So everyone talks about like a 360 recruiter, or talks about like a full stack recruiter, but actually talking about nuances within it, like the methods at which they do their work. So like agile recruiter, or with Amber we used to talk a lot about the cognitive recruiter, so augmented with technology. So I think you're both spot on. I think now we come together and we say, okay, these are the new profiles.
Well, let's get into it, Kevin, because you've already tapped into something that I think we do want to talk about, because traditionally a recruiter has been a 360 recruiter, in my view. In other words, someone who owns the requisition from the start to the delivery. He or she takes the requirement, manages the process, gets the pipeline, interviews the candidates, schedules the interviews, delivers the shortlist, does all of that stuff until the person is sitting there, bums on seats. I think that's probably still 90% of the people doing recruitment as a job. Mm-hmm. Would probably qualify as that. Certainly that was back in my day, this is what I did. Now, are you saying that this function is changing or needs to change, or how would you kind of define the future for this type of profile?
Sure. I think when you say, is it changing or does it need to change? It is changing because of the need to change and to be right. different. And I think one of the things we're going to see through the 2020s, if you like, is definitely the rise of what I would term talent operation. So, you know, if you think about talent operation, I mean, I've had ops leaders for probably in the capacity of being TA lead for maybe 10 years since I identified the need. And it's very orientated around a reporting relationship, right? Or an information gathering or, you know, a static data or historical data. But as we move forward, I think talent operations is going to become more broad. And what you'll see is, if you think about recruiting as like a commercial function, like a recruiter being commercially orientated towards the outcome, you know, you couldn't have sales and marketing without the significant amount of enablement that goes around those organizations. And so as you start to see talent operations evolve, I think you're going to see probably more transformation in the roles and the profiles that operate within that, probably some building out of those teams and those organizational structures within, certainly within enterprise customers, because as we move forward, whatever the profile of the recruiter is going to look like, one of the things we're going to start to really notice is there's going to need to be an orientation around different things. Now, that orientation may be around the responsiveness to data, which I think is critical. And I don't just mean like, oh, I see this, so I go do this. I mean, like, you know, being able to be that kind of data poet, so see things in terms of like global data and global insights and be able to react accordingly. I talked a lot last year, towards the end of last year, at a few different events. I talked about one of my frustrations, and this is partially why, you know, I think, you know, it's, you know, my motivation to do something different really clicked home is, you know, for so long, you know, recruitment and recruiters have existed with the ability to be self-directing. And what I mean is they come in, they see a list of 20 requisitions, and they basically say, well, that's what I'm going to do today. Without the talent operations underpinning that with insights and data, how do they know that they're maximizing for opportunity? How do we know they're optimizing for success of the organization? How do they know they're even working on what is legitimate priorities for the organization? How do they know that they're, you know, that they're in a position where they're consuming multiple data points to make effective decisions? Before you even get into how they work with technology, how they work augmented with technology, how they work through automation, how they use technology to enable the community that they support. At the very foundation of it is, what work should I be doing? Before I even get into how I'm going to do the work, am I going to be agile? Am I going to be, a traditional full stack recruiter? It's like, what should I be doing? How do I max? And I think that's the first part. When I say the rise of talent operations in the 2020, that's where the foundation starts. I see some nodding from Adam, so it seems like we're pretty well aligned there. So.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think that recruiters in agencies and in corporate have been given too much freedom to choose how they spend their time. Not just what roles, they've got a list of 20 roles. What roles should they work on? Because naturally, they're going to work on the ones that they think are easier, or they're going to work on the ones that they think are more fun. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, they've been given too much freedom to go and choose which candidates to go and prioritize as well. So I think there could be some guardrails up in lots of different ways, which, yes, it might dictate a recruiter's day a little bit more than they're getting just now, but it's going to optimize them for success and effectiveness completely.
No, 100% agree. And you touched on there again about the work, and you said, you know, which candidates to choose. But think about even the channel strategy, right? Think about, like, you know, if you are hiring, you know, let's say local to where I'm at, I think where Hunger is for sure. You know, if you're looking for full stack engineers in London, right? You know, developers, you know, you could, the traditional process is, well, we post everything and we put it on these job boards and we create application data. But if you've got intelligent data behind that from talent operations that says, if you post this, you're going to get, you know, 3,000 applications, of which we have no history. The market sensitivity, the market scarcity dictates that actually you won't be able to fill that via that channel, but you're going to spend 3.5 days across a 65-day hiring cycle dispositioning or reviewing applicant candidates that we can tell you aren't suitable. Then don't post it. Right? You know, and so you're in these positions around, you know, use the technology to say, you know what, get in the CRM, get in the ATS, get on LinkedIn recruiter. That's where you're going to find this candidate. You're not going to find it by just following that arbitrary step that's set out in a roadmap that says this is what we do.
So I spoke to a tech recruitment business in London a few days ago who kept talking about LinkedIn and the importance of LinkedIn. I'm thinking, I'm scratching my head here a little bit going, why do they keep talking about LinkedIn all the time? They're hiring software developers. And it occurred to me that they weren't aware of other channels. Mm-hmm. So they've got no data to tell them where candidates are coming from, and the fact that actually they're getting nothing really from LinkedIn, yet they're prioritizing it as the main channel for them. So,
yeah,
I mean, it's all about data, and it's all about data coming into people at the right time, mm-hmm. as in first thing in the morning, probably.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. All of this sounds really good, guys, but I'm just trying to think. Okay, I'm listening into this, and I'm thinking, Kev, yeah, you're totally spot on. I totally need a talent op function, but right now they're sitting there with a pyramid of like 360 recruiters. Like, what? How do they go about taking step one into building this what might be a completely new function? Because this is something that, I mean, a lot of companies simply don't carry. They don't carry people that are called this thing.
Yeah, no, and I agree. But you can take, I mean, even without a talent operations function, even if you're in an, and this is the thing why I loved the work that I've done over the last couple of years, because, you know, I've spoken at different events and some of you guys have been at, and people said, well, that's easy because you're IBM, or that's easy because you're Cisco and you have these infinite amount of resources. Well, I'll tell you, proportionally, based on the volume of hiring, I wouldn't necessarily say that was always the case. But certainly from the point of view of, like, these methodologies and these approaches, yeah, you know, if you can't, you know, enable through technology because budget can change, but you can apply some of the principles. So you can apply some, so for example, if you think about agile methodology, you know, to really, you know, put in disproportional focus around certain elements of the work, around creating guardrails to ensure that, you know, the velocity is maintained through the process. If you talk about even the prioritization of your work, if you've got 10 requisitions, you go, you know, what, I guess, you know, the example I use sometimes is I talk about how traditional recruitment leaders have thought about capacity. I have 100 requisitions and I have 5 recruiters. What do I do? I give them 20 each, right? That's been the traditional thing. You know, amortize the work. Not me. I give 150, 130, and then 3 on the 20 that are going to impact the business, that are actually going to drive or propel a business's growth. So, you know, you stack 1 to 10, 3 recruiters on my top 5 requisitions, 3 requisitions, you know. And so by having disproportional focus on where we create value and where we spend our efforts, how we even deliver that work. You know, you think about recruitment as a service provision. You don't have... You know, if a technology company, a service provision technology company, if they win a contract to support the IT infrastructure of a major organization, they don't just bundle really expensive heads into their corporate head office. They have a distributed model of service, right? They have, you know, like local, nearshore, offshore, on-site to ensure that the work is done. And so whilst you might not want to do that with your team, you can definitely think about how the work is distributed among your team to provide different service levels. It's funny, when you two were talking about in the intro about the reason why Adam's the biggest promoter of Recruiting Brave Food, and you said, because you add content, you don't just share it. You know, you think about, like, you know, one of the skills of a recruiter around that being that social seller, you know, that may be the content. Those 1 to 3 roles is you add content to it. You don't just post a link. You don't just push the job out. You actually go and add content. You maybe not give it the Dominic Cummings spin, although I'm probably more on Adam's side of the fence than the straw poll. You obviously didn't come to me for the straw poll. I'm probably not as far as Adam in the endorsement, but I'm definitely I'm definitely on that side of the middle ground. But yeah, no, and I think that's so taking that kind of thinking, you can take that down to where you have 5 recruiters and, you know, 20 requisitions. Like, the methodology is solid.
All right. Adam, I know you're going to say something, but I just want to jump in here because this is super interesting already, especially when you talked about how you would divide the labor. When you said, look, as 100 requisitions, it's going to go 20 each, everyone's nodding their heads. I was nodding my head. Of course, that's what you would do. But you're saying, no, what you need to do is actually identify what are the absolutely business critical roles and actually over resource on that, make sure they're nailed, and then you kind of just cover it with some other tooling and other candidates and other resources in the group. Now, this recruiter or these recruiters that now have got lower requisition volume on the business critical roles, what kind of skills do they need? in order to get these people in. I mean, is it a different recruiter from the guy that's doing the 50 roles or the volume stuff? I mean, do you identify this as a different person, or is it just simply they've got a different focus for the time being?
No, I think it's a different profile. And again, this conversation I was having yesterday with a couple of peers, we were actually talking about this, not to a great extent, because we actually decided we need to get together and we need to define it and kind of bring it to people like you guys, like industry thought leaders, and say, you know, can we all get behind this? Can we all start talking a consistent language about this new profile? And so as we do that, we start to, you know, kind of create those discussions. You know, there are some things in there that need. I think one is if you're moving towards, you know, almost like what I would term as like statement of work type recruitment, very IR35 topical for those of you in the UK. But if you move to like more statement of work, instead of saying, you know, I have 20 requisitions, and so therefore that's 20 individual instances and 20 individual sets of activities. Actually start, as you start to group your resource around project oriented work and not think about the number of requisitions necessarily, but actually think about the work involved in needing to do that. You need to have things like design thinking skills. So how can you effectively plan a project to execute within those prioritized roles? So you start to think, okay, so this is the outcome we want to get to. How do we reverse engineer into that based on a super aggressive timeline for outcome? And I think these are some of the things that, you know, so design thinking is definitely one. The second thing is being that data power, that person that can really deeply understand the data or have the data in aggregated in a way that it links to the decision-making process. So being able to look at, kind of what we touched on before, is there any point in me pushing this out to an advert? You know, what needs to be my individual channel strategy? So having, you know, being more upfront with the data and treating recruitment data less like it should be historical and more like, you know, I always think of it as like, you know, up until a short time ago, recruitment data was always considered the rear view mirror to the activity. You know, it's kind of, you're always looking behind at what we did.
And yeah, it's a report. Yeah.
Let's look at what we've done. Let's see what we can learn from it. But actually the availability of data through market intelligence, market scarcity, your propensity to hire as a company, where you potentially fit in terms of culture, values, based on, you know, some of the websites that are able to give you those insights, based on your propensity to offer salaries that can attract those type of individuals, you're able to look at all of these data points and actually say, okay, if we're reverse and engineering into this project, what is our project plan? How do we need to design our way into success? So I think that's going to become a much more apparent skills profile. And in the absence of a highly sophisticated talent operations organization, to the point we were just talking about, you know, you need to be operating for effectiveness. You need to be optimizing yourself. You need to be looking at the 20 requisitions and making commercial decisions, like intelligent, smart commercial decisions. Where if I sat down with the CEO, irrespective of the size of the company, and I showed them my roster of activity, where would they see the value? Every hiring manager you talk to, their role is the most important role. So you don't want you going out to every hiring manager and say, you know, these, I'm working for you 10 hiring managers. I want you to self-direct to give me your 1 to 10 of priority. They all come back with 1 or 2, right? And so, you know, it's about putting yourself in the shoes of the CEO, putting yourself into the revenue generating role of the company and saying, as I look at my 20, as I look at my 10, this is where I need to maximize my impact. You know, and then possibly managing different flavors around even the same recruiter, if it's not different recruit by well, the same recruiter managing reps differently.
So yeah, before you go in, I'm just gonna say, I've just shared a link, quadratic voting, folks. Quadratic voting may be the solution to that. Check out that link. Adam, go ahead.
First of all, John Rose has asked a question. Just going back to the talent operations thing. Should talent operations or recruitment ops combine and move out of HR into another area?
Okay, so that's a difficult question to answer, and I'll tell you for why. Because HR departments around analytics have different levels of sophistication. I was trying to explain it to somebody who doesn't work in our sector the other day. They actually worked in the IT sector, and I was explaining about the as in an IT role within the sector, not as in post of recruitment work. And I was explaining to them, as like, if you look at the role of the CHRO today, It's in a generational shift. So taking the question a bit higher, and then I'll bring it back down. It's in a generational shift that I liken to IT directors at the end of the 90s. So when I started working, IT directors were there for email provisioning, tech support, thin client networks, all of those things that we all remember. Then all of a sudden, the CEO said, actually, technology is a route to revenue and a route to growth for the company. So I need my IT director to become a CTO, right? So it's no longer infrastructure. It's about enabling a business to drive growth and revenue. The same has been asked of the personnel department, if we go back, right? The personnel department was process, policy, you know, expenses, all of that, you know, all of that kind of stuff, hiring, firing. But they then got asked to do is say, no, HR needs to commercialize our business through people. It needs to drive growth and activity. So there's a lot been hit in the CHROs in the last couple of years. And to one extent or another, things have slid off that desk, right? I've seen, you know, heads of TA who've gone from reporting to the CHRO to being minus 2-3 layers into the organization because for whatever reason, they prioritized other work. I've also seen heads of TA elevated from 3 or 4 layers down into the CHRO. And so depending on a company's sophistication around insights and analytics and HR operations, you'd probably want to make a judgment call. I would say that they're kind of naturally well heard, but if the CHROs dive in a different agenda, if the HR operations function is really inwardly focused, what does our internal population look like? How do we enable our hiring managers to our managers to be able to identify talent? There's not enough talent in the market. How do we infer success? So that's a part of HR operations. If all that's pointed internally, you might not be able to, you know, you might end up finding yourself, if you're trying to get some of that time, you might be in the high chair at the big table, you know, and you don't, you know, you want to make sure that you're part of the conversation around this is what I need, this is what we need to enable ourselves through talent acquisition, and then you've got to figure out where it fits. So there's no right or wrong answer to the question. I think it's around maturity of HR operations.
So I think that's a great answer, and I agree it's about maturity of HR operations, but from what I can see, any CHRO that has not got the skills to be able to create an internal ops team probably needs fired in 2020, because there's no way that a medium-sized HR function should not be capable of creating all of this data analytics and the technology and framework and all of that sort of stuff to be able to perform at that level.
I agree with you, and this is where the vendors have got to play a role, right? This is when I went to the back to the top of the conversation when I came in, I was saying that, you know, one of the appetites for change was I think that vendors need to take more responsibility in helping guide operating model and business activity in a way that's not just around creating, you know, a better UI UX and kind of selling on features and benefits, but actually being able to sell, be able to position yourself as we can help you take on that journey. Because again, back to my point, you've got a generational shift, so you do have a bunch of HR leaders who are potentially having to go on their own journey to make that shift because they've grown up in one world. We're asking them to move to another one, or the CEO is, and they need help. So it might not be a lack of capability or a lack of appetite to do it. It might be just a lack of not knowing how to get there and how can, you know, a smart vendor strategy internally by bringing in the right people, by bringing in the right organizations, help them enable that. And I think that's an important point of where everybody's at, you know. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, is it okay to not know what we don't know? And I think it is. And I think it's okay to create a platform of help where we can get in and enable these functions.
So it's good for vendors to be able to help shape what the function should look like, but when they're told, they're effectively told, and I paraphrase, get back in your box, you're a vendor, you don't know anything about it, it's quite difficult to do that. So
I don't know. I've got a, maybe I can hit them with my resume. I've done the job.
Absolutely. I think you should get that out. Otherwise, recalibration might be in order.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see my reaction when I get my first one of them. You're probably used to dealing with it. And you're like, you know, I know that's coming, whereas I'm probably going to be a little bit more, oh, wow, okay.
So I think we've talked about, the things that we've talked about sound to me like they're more about sort of process, and they're probably more about considerations for like the TA director or even manager level people around how they structure things and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to actual skills. So what do you think the skills are that a successful recruiters need in 2020, maybe compared to, say, 10 years ago when things were different?
Yeah, I mean, I still think there's some foundational skills. You know, I think obviously because the advent of technology and the way we approach candidates, a greater level of literacy in the non-spoken word, so that, you know, the way in which you engage, the way in which you're able to articulate and personalize, and that's really critical. And I know that there's a lot of work gets done around personalization, but the ability to be able to personalize and scale through creative writing, through the ability to generate or assess or deliver creative content. It used to be, and you mentioned agency earlier on, you mentioned a third party agency, and the type of profile they have in the recruiting, you say, you know, there's probably not many introverts in there. There's probably not. There's probably a bunch of people that are very comfortable with the idea of phone selling or face-to-face selling. That's less our job. It's still required, and I still love to see recruiters on the phone. I still think that's a major assessment point. But actually now aligning that up to, okay, you know, similar to how you'd ask a coder, you know, it's not unheard of to say to a coder, give me examples of your work. Well, you know, I think the first thing is when I see a recruiter's CV, they're writing about themselves. If they can't articulate a compelling story, then how do they do that through the work that they do in LinkedIn emails, LinkedIn inboxes? So asking for examples of content creation, like where have you created content? Where have you been original in terms of, you know, creating a compelling case? So the selling skill is more or less about, you know, sell me this pen. Remember that? Everyone's had that interview, right? Sell me this pen, right? I've had it a few times. You know, it's less about sell me this pen. And it's more like, tell me what's good about this pen and how this pen is better than the other pens that I have on my desk. And how do you articulate that, you know? And I think that, you know, that's a key area for sure.
So I think you're right. And actually, I think it's partially about something we've already spoken about. So in that company, there's probably, I don't know, 2,000 recruiters across the world who are great on the phone, but there's probably almost none of them who can write like Dominic Cummings. So I think, you know, those kinds of influence, you know, being able to achieve influence in different channels, in different formats is something that I totally agree recruiters need to be much better at on the whole.
Well, on that note, I mean, the format has changed. I think Adam and I were talking about this kind of in the green room earlier about, because we're all old enough, I think, to remember the days when the phone skills was the dominant thing. You know, if you weren't good at the phone, you know what, you ain't got the job. But then I kind of in the 2010s, probably the late noughties, you got to the point where actually you could see people who couldn't write an email. You know, even people who didn't have decent keyboard skills, you can see actually these people are going to struggle. I remember very clearly back in my day, there was one of these great recruiters one of these great phone recruiters, and I just saw him at the keyboard and he was still like typing in one finger at a time. And I was thinking, you know what, this guy was really, really top of his game for a long, long time, but I don't think he's going to carry that form into the near future, because it's going to be ever more dominant that we're going to be communicating in a written way than we are over the telephone.
What's happened is that person that you're talking about, the brilliant phone seller, the brilliant phone recruiter, that person got promoted and then promoted again and then promoted again. And now they're either running their own recruitment business or they're CEO of some sort of stock market listed recruitment business, and they're teaching everybody else to be like them. So you still see some of the training programs where, especially in recruitment agencies, where a lot of it is focused on, you know, achieving influence on the phone.
Yeah, it's still a skill. I respect it massively. I mean, I think I was all right at it, to be honest. But I don't pick up the phone to anybody anymore, I've realized. Like literally whoever calls, I just don't pick it up. It's got to be pre-scheduled. So if you're going to pre-schedule it in a non-verbal way, that's got to be set up in some written form. Mm-hmm. So the primacy, I think, is shifted to written. Question is, in 2020, is there going to be another shift going forward? Is video, for instance, going to overtake the written sort of text? Because we're struggling to read that much these days. You know, what is the outreach channel that's going to be the dominant one in the next decade?
It's funny that you say that, actually, because as we were talking about that, I was just thinking about the dynamic shift. I talk about like content creation and being able to articulate a value through the written word. But then as a recruiter, you're going to have to make a channel strategy decision. I certainly, you know, no one was advocating for text messaging of candidates and hiring managers, you know, as near as, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. But now WhatsApp, you know, text, perfectly acceptable means of communication. You and I communicate almost exclusively through Facebook, you know, about all things professional and personal. And so to that end, I think there's, that from a perspective of, you know, not just what you create, but how the appropriateness of the channel and how you want to show up in that channel and the level of formality, informality that creates and engenders the relationship part. So it shifts from, okay, we talk about the shift in dynamic of selling. We now talk about the shift in dynamic of relationships of, right, you know, the different channels have opened up different elements to talk to. One of the things we, as we look at the kind of profile of the recruiter, one of the things that's really apparent to me, you know, really starting to do some coaching around to some of the TA leaders I work with, is very much based around thinking about that traditional one directional route to market strategy. Decisions are made much more in an ecosystem right now. And I'm not talking necessarily about collective responsibility, because you do get that in some organizations where everything has to be decision by consent and consensus. But I think actually more around the ability to influence the ecosystem, the constituent parts, whether it be talent operations, whether it be, you know, the multifaceted recruiters and sourcing organization you may have, but also in terms of out into the organization, the business, and the way, if you're building different approaches to recruitment, different strategies like Agile, you know, you need to be able to influence in a slightly different way, because you may not be dealing with the decision makers, you know, to a huge extent. So that kind of like relationship dynamic is changing.
Kevin, you might find this interesting. I spoke to a TA leader just in December before Christmas, who said they were hiring an exec recruiter recently. And when they were interviewing the people, he said to every single one of them, okay, take out your phone, go into your WhatsApp, and just tell me about candidates you've been closing on WhatsApp recently. Mm-hmm. And those who have been having multiple conversations with potential candidates using WhatsApp as part of it, he said these people are close enough to their candidates that they're WhatsApping each other. Others who weren't doing it, he said that says something about them. It says that maybe they're not close enough to their candidates.
Mm-hmm. And what you tie into then is, you know, and again, potentially, I don't know the answer to this, is we talked before about differentiating approach, and we go back to our 10 roles, the three recruiters on the three. So is there an expectation that those three recruiters on the three or four roles would probably be more scaled than that, economic viability? But what you'd have is, do they have a different channel strategy to the people that are doing roles 7, 8, and 9, which is, you know, there's one recruiter out there doing that, potentially covering more ground, is that an efficiency and a productivity play that they use things like WhatsApp and text? And on the front end, that it's a relationship play? Is it homogenized, that it's just good practice all the way across the board? I mean, if you do get into these things around, then it's like, okay, recruiters using the channel strategy differently to achieve different outcomes, productivity versus experiences.
It's a really good point, because the certain types of things you talk about WhatsApp there, Adam, but obviously that's a very much a one-to-one thing. I don't know whether anybody's ever been brought into, you know, an involuntary WhatsApp group. It's the worst experience ever, isn't it? You go, oh my goodness, I'm leaving the chat straight away, that kind of thing. But from a candidate point of view, if I'm one of these kind of low volume, high touched individuals, you can see maybe a one-to-one channel is going to be the right one. But if I'm the fellow or the girl who's managing 50 requirements, 100 requirements, I'm just covering all of the volume stuff that, you know, perhaps isn't business critical in the short term, then obviously I need to perhaps use more traditional means, I guess. So yeah, very interesting on the channel selection side. I want to talk about the data poetry.
Adam's just hit on a real thing for me. He's just type the school parents WhatsApp group. But you see, the difference with that one is that's the group you have to stay in. So that's the one that you get added to involuntarily. But to be the person that, you know, Kevin, Hung, Adam has left this group is playground politics suicide. So you can't go
there. I'm sure you can mute it.
My wife messaged me this morning, a WhatsApp message, and it simply said, don't comment, do not say anything. I looked at it and I went, that'll be about the parents group. I went into the parents group, and it's honestly, it's things like, oh, should I give my kid tuna sandwich or ham sandwich this morning? It's like, I don't want this, but you can't leave.
Very interesting. I want to get onto data poetry because that's kind of your term that you've coined in the industry, Kevin. And I want to explore what exactly type of profile of person did you recruit for that? Did you find this person at IBM from a recruitment background, or did you go from outside of the industry to bring this person into the team?
So sorry, I missed the very first word you said because the video jumped. So was that
data poet, man?
Data poet. Okay. So it's a profile you've got to train for, because if you're saying this is our bar for data insights and being able to operationalize those insights, because that's the other important thing. I know that when you talk to like some of the strategy that a lot of vendors have had over the last couple of years, it's been around, but we can produce all this data, but if we can't help you operationalize it, it's just a lot of data, right? And so there is this element of what can you, when you look at the strategy of organizations that support you from a technological perspective and what they give you, to what level or to what extent do they need to really be using, do they need to be thinking beyond that and consolidating their viewpoint around that? It's definitely something I believe that, you know, right now, it's something you have to coach for, but you have to create an ecosystem of support. So one of the things I was very big on was using social tools across my entire organization, across my team, to open source the experiences, right? And to create a less of a platform around one person's going to stand there with a slide and say, this is how I become a data poet, but more about sharing anecdotal stories, more about sharing micro pieces of data or insight that basically say, hey, this is some success I've just had because I considered it like this. And allowing somebody, rather than be really prescriptive and write a list and say, well, this is what a really good data pilot looks like. They use the augmentation of the systems and they create an architecture and then they use design thinking to reverse engineer from the role back in as to where they need to be at different points of the steps. But actually finding what works for them in terms of, you know, the orientation around different roles, because some of the examples we've touched on is these three different dimensions of requisition. Is a data poet that's working on our top three different to the data poet that's working on the bottom three? Absolutely, because they're looking at different outcomes at different levels of velocity with different levels of capacity to do that work. So therefore, you're creating a much stronger platform of development within your own team. And again, and I don't mean to bother about it, but I think this is the inflection. It's going out to your technology providers and the vendors and saying, you know, we have an expectation that you can help enable here. Right, and that you're gonna give us the opportunity to, you know, take insights and make effective decisions down to the individual contributor level, democratizing the data.
Kevin, just picking up on some questions that have come in on the chat, there, really interesting, particularly from Divakar and from Anna there, and this kind of led on to the first thing you said when we were referring to that data point. How do you upskill the TA team? I mean, is there any techniques that you've found effective in doing this? And at what point do you make the decision, actually, I can't invest the time to do this, I actually need to hire a different profile?
Yeah, no, I can give a good example. So the person that we had responsibility for what we would term TA enablement, so the person that I had in my organization, that actually, to be fair, I inherited, but as I inherited, turned out to be exceptionally right person for the strategy you want to develop, came from a sales enablement background. So I think many people know Alike Peach. So Alike, it was originally in sales, and when she moved across to human resources, she was put her actual role was talent acquisition enablement. And so she was responsible for the upskilling, the learning, the development, the profile creation alongside me, the role profiles, the expectation of work, the workflow of recruiters. So where do we automate? Where do we simplify? What do we remove? And so having all of that connected, but not necessarily through what I would call, in some ways, like a prejudiced recruitment lens, as because, you know, and I put myself into that category because I'm in my third generation of recruiting years now. I guess certainly moving into my third decade of being in recruiting. And so for me, you know, I have obviously picked up these biases through my experiences. And so bringing somebody in who's an expert in a different sector, but solving a similar kind of problem about tying the outcome, which we now know is commercial, which we're going to articulate more and more as the impact of revenues, we start to get into prioritization and actually starting to you know, what is good data and what is not so good data, and how do you lean on it? And the one of the big things that I, you know, really like to look at is the idea of smart data. So, you know, not just elevating this dumb data, not just elevating, you know, something that's static, but actually having smart data that interconnects with other data to create a more of a, again, it's back to that ecosystem, an ecosystem of data and having some use it. So I personally, you know, looked outside of the sector and thought that was the right strategy. So putting that expertise around you. But I think there's a lot to be, can be automated here.
So I was just going to say, I put in the comments there that from my experience of sales operations and marketing operations, there's no real difference between that and talent acquisition. George has just commented that he agrees mirrored, but sales and marketing analogies do break in recruiting. I'm not really sure they do. If you just talk about sales, yes, recruitment's not the same. If you just talk about marketing, recruitment's not the same. I don't really see any difference in your combined sales and marketing and talent acquisition.
So the interesting thing on that, Adam, is I actually agree with both of you. I'm not to sit on the fence, because I never sit on the fence, as you guys know. But not sit on the fence. There's different types of selling. There's commoditized selling. There's solution selling. And so, you know, where are you drawing your inspiration? Like, what type of talent operation are you running? And what are the outcomes you're trying to drive? So I would imagine if you are retail selling, or you are selling something that's heavily commoditized, stacked high, and sold cheap, that's a very different approach. That's possibly more akin to a different profile of recruiter than the one where actually you're creating a service model, you're creating a platform to deliver something that in essence is, you know, is more end-to-end orientated, that has, and if you're going to start looking at talent end-to-end, which we all need to, which, you know, has, you know, it probably involves a level of, you know, post-sale support. So we've got pre-sale sales and support now as part of our jobs, and thinking into that profile of recruiter, you know, talent is end-to-end, because you're possibly pulling from more sophisticated means to make assessments.
So do you think...
go ahead, one more.
Should the person who is liaising with hiring managers and basically ensuring fulfillment, jobs are getting filled, should they be doing sourcing? Should they be doing marketing or nurture? And should they be doing onboarding?
My personal view is yes, but enabled through TA. Yeah. So I, it's not exclusively that. I mean, you can't always say, you know, that you, every manager should be outsourced and every manager should be doing like sophisticated bespoke onboarding. But what I do think is that, you know, the talent acquisition organization needs to have consumable products that can be deployed in different ways. So again, we go back to what we talked about before, prioritization. If you're limited on resource, or you need to double down in certain areas, your role's 8 to 10, maybe self-service. You know, back to our list, we've got 3 recruiters up on the top 3. Your 8 to 10, maybe actually that's self-service. We're enable a manager to post their own requisition through a validated process of checks. And then they post it, and they deal with the application response. And actually, you know, there are a number of companies you go into where managers are very deeply immersed in the talent acquisition organization, in the talent acquisition process. I've even been in some organizations where managers refuse to use their own TA team, not as in I've been in to help solution, where managers are just like, yeah, we just do it all ourselves, you know? And so, and actually, they don't seem to have a huge appetite to change it. So then you democratize your technology. You have, you know, do you open up your ATS, you open up your CRM, do you open up, you know, your HRIS? Do you actually, you bring in a bespoke, like an events tool, and say, you guys hang out in these communities, you're in, you know, these different online, these platforms, you're a credible voice in security architecture. You can create your own event now here. And if you make your own hire, and guess what? If you've got a sophisticated way of doing that, you know, you're not, you're actually potentially creating better experiences. Not always, because...
What I'm getting from this, Kevin, is actually TA shouldn't look at itself as the full owner of all the requisitions. They shouldn't be greedy in that way. They should prioritize between what is absolutely business critical, double down on that, and apply resources and expertise there. But then at the very edges of it, where it's kind of lower priority, you've got to maybe even think about pushing it back to the manager and say, hey, listen, this is a job we need to recruit as a business, but right now you've got to do it on your own. I think that kind of flexible thinking, you know, you're kind of oscillating the scope of TA, depending on the resource and the capacity of it and the priority of it, is super, super interesting. Kevin, we're coming down to kind of the last couple of minutes. So I just want to hit on a few kind of quick zingers before we leave it. We talk about must have recruiter skills for 2020. Give me 3 things that you think recruiters really need to be self-developing and thinking about going into this next decade. And in fact, 3 things that you think recruiters probably should be deprioritizing because, you know, the world is changing and we're not going to do that anymore.
Yeah, so I mean, I think certainly in terms of the things they should have, we've hit on them to one degree or other. So first of all is the data poetry piece, is being able to take all the data, build on it, and have that embedded and operationalized in the way you do your everyday job. The second part is the ability to work in an agile way. Now, whatever that means, and whatever your inference of architecture of agile is, but actually being able to look at things on a retrospective, on a backlog, being able to understand the destination and the steps that, you know, how you build the tree a branch at a time is also critical. I'm gonna do four, by the way. So I know you asked for three, but I like to over deliver on it. So, but the third one is one thing I mentioned before, is around the design thinking. So that ability to architect a solution for a manager, the ability to start to craft as you start to think about these prioritization, the way the work gets done, is being able to design solutions using your platforms that are available to you, and being able to, you know, put something in front of, and that applies to all levels. I'm talking about, you know, TA executive, the roles that I've done in the last 6 or 7 years. Right down to the leadership chains that sit beneath that, to the recruiter. And then the final part is that multi-channel communication strategy. Communications, we would have said 10 years ago, communication we would have said 5 years ago. It's this sophistication around the multi-channel communication strategy. The three things I wouldn't necessarily say switch off, but I mean, clearly, you know, you want to start pushing away the administrative burden. You don't know, being excellent around the administrative elements of the work is probably not going to serve you well as we start to drive towards automation across the board, or certainly heavily augmented automation. So if you're over rotating on the sophistication of how good you are in the tools, well, guess what, a lot of that's going to get automated. If you're over rotating, so you know, kind of go with the direction of the market to some extent on that. I think the idea of that very narrow sales strategy and sales focus, like the idea that, you know, you're not opening up the aperture to multiple channels. So the idea that you're an expert in, you know, and I don't want to, you know, fall out with someone like Google Dave, but you're just really good at writing Boolean strings isn't going to be sufficient in the future. And create, you know, that multi-channel. I know he is all of that. It's just because it's in his name. But being able to write being able to do that. And then I think the idea that, you know, you're orientated around superficial, deeply embedded individual relationships. So back to that democratized ecosystem of decision, the fact that, you know, I have a strong relationship with that leader is going to be democratizing their work around hiring. So, you know, the ability, you know, so just having like that, not, you know, just going really deep on very small amounts of relationships and not being able to democratize that across a much greater group might be an issue.
That's fantastic, Kevin. I hope someone was making notes there, because there was four pluses and three minuses there, which I think someone should be writing up as a blog post. That's fantastic. Kevin Blair, I think we could talk forever with you. You're such a fantastic guest. You're also probably a Scouser with a bigger vocabulary than I've ever come across in my entire life. So that's a remarkable fact also.
It's a terrible stereotype.
It is, but you know what? It's an on-PC show. But yeah, thank you, Kevin, for your time. I look forward to seeing you now that you're in. I'm probably going to be in town a little bit more than has been the case. So yeah, we'll no doubt catch up on that. Have a very good weekend, sir. Adam, thank you again for being a superb co-host. Always been a pleasure sharing time with you. Everyone who's been watching on the Facebook and on Brain Food Live, thank you very much for your time. This will also be a podcast in due course. So if you want to listen audio only, you can do that. And thank you to our sponsors, Pass. Once again, check them out. If you're doing background checking in the old-fashioned way, forget about that. Get onto their link and get a free trial. Okay, that's it. Next week, we'll be back with Jerome Turning at Smart Recruiters talking social good for hiring success. Cool. So make sure you sign in for that, guys. All right, have a good weekend, everyone. Great seeing you.
Cheers.